this year, from all reports and what we see here today, we have been inundated. So this is really a magnificent collection. COMA, for instance, acronym for the Connecticut Westchester Metropolitan Association, has a four-day foray every year around Labor Day, end of August, beginning of September. It's a four-day weekend, and it is devoted to going out in the woods with professional mycologists and finding species of mushrooms, just as we did today. Usually there is a session of mycophagy, which means eating fungi, and we have some excellent cooks, some of whom are here today joining us, Joe and Kathy Grant, for instance, who prepare mushroom dishes that are carefully vetted by professional mycologists. And then we have lectures and camaraderie and hoopla, everything that goes with a mushroom foray of that length. But that's really an intensive experience. If you're interested in mycology, I ask you to really consider that. You can go online and look for COMA's website, and there's plenty of information about the foray there.
COMA website is comafungi.org. Foray will be Labor Day weekend.
Thank you, Joe. It just occurred just last month. So I think I didn't attend that one personally, but I think we did very well. In terms of people's interest in mycology, I always think of the narrative that we construct around that after we get really interested in it. And everyone has their own story, which is like a myth of origins and how we get into this sport, so-called. And I'll tell you mine, because people ask all the time, and it was about a quarter of a century ago, about 25 years ago, that my older daughter was interested in a wildflower collection. So we said, well, go out and collect wildflowers and press the flowers and make our own little herbarium and learn our species. And while we did that, we started seeing all the mushrooms out there. And the colorful mushrooms attracted us just as much as the wildflowers, and we kind of took off and got interested in that. We went to a lecture of Sylvia Stein, who was a mushroom trail friend of John Cage, and she saw an entire family to inoculate the science of mycology. So she took us under her wing and really, really taught us the species. My wife Sue and I actually went to a lecture of Sylvia Stein, and we got there on the wrong day. We were so interested that we went back the next day when it was actually scheduled. And this woman knew her species down to every last one. She was really a powerhouse, a really intellectual powerhouse about mycology. She lectured throughout Westchester County and the Bronx, including once taking over Gary Lindkoff's course at the New York Botanical Garden. And that's how we really got into it. And our first foray for the Connecticut Westchester Mycological Association, the family of four of us went, and people were complaining, there's just no mushrooms out there. And they were bringing back what we thought was quite a lot. And I was a little perplexed at that. There were a few hundred species collected, and I thought it was quite remarkable. And everyone kept saying, oh, it's the driest summer in 10 years, and we're sorry you attended on such a terrible occasion. We thought, what are you talking about? So the next year when we went to the COMA foray, it was kind of like this. We were tripping over mushrooms on the campus where we were staying. There were so many things out there, you couldn't go 20 yards without picking all sorts of pole beets, ammonitis, and whatnot. And that's my story of origins of how I got into mycology. And it was really a wonderful group to be with. So we're out on the mushroom trail, and we're collecting mushrooms like this, like we did today, and we need to be able to identify them. So, some simple things about identification. Many people look at mushrooms and then go to Google Images or go to a mushroom book or a mushroom app or whatever and compare pictures. That has limited utility. It's good to do. I do it. You do it. You should do it. But that's not the way really to really learn your species. And what Sylvia taught me was really to write down what you see. To look at the anatomy of a mushroom, like this Amanita, describe its cap, look at its gills, look at how the gills are attached to the stipe, or whether they're attached to the stipe, whether it has a ring on the site, whether it has a bulbous base, the color of the cap, the texture of the cap, the texture of the site, does it have matter on it, does it have concentric rings, are there fringes around the edge of the cap, is the cap striate? There's a whole host of anatomical characteristics that one must focus in on in really coming to terms with actual mushroom species. Gary Linkup always told me, if you can identify most of the mushrooms that you find out in the woods to genus, you are doing really great. So don't assume that you need to put a name on every mushroom. One WAG once said that the difference between an amateur and a professional mycologist is this. An amateur always wants to put a name on a mushroom. A professional always wants to put a correct name on a mushroom. So we're out in the woods today flinging about names and hoping we know what we're talking about and sometimes getting it right and sometimes not, and that's part of the process of learning. After all, John Cake said, mushrooms are teaching machines. And I'll get to that later in my talk this afternoon. But all of those things are important in terms of coming to grips with this profusion of fungi. And you say, if you're a novice to this, you look at this, well, how am I going to make sense of all of this? Well, one of the major differences is this. And I won't talk too much more because I want to turn it over to Britt, who really does know his species and all the ecological relationships among mushrooms and trees and things like that. But there's a great division of two phyla, basidiomycetes and ascomycetes. Most of what we're seeing here today are basidiomycetes. How do you determine the difference? Well, you need a microscope. If you don't have a microscope, you really can't determine the difference for the species you have in hand. Because a basidiomycete is a mushroom, a gill mushroom, a polypore, gastromycete like a puffball that has a small structure on the gills or the hymenium that has four spores, usually four. And the basidium is a microscopic structure. You cannot see it with the naked eye. You need to have a microscope. A lens will not do. It must be a microscope. And you can see the four basidia on the basidium. You can see the four spores on the basidium. So those spores are shot off of the basidium in a great profusion, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. The other major group is ascomycetes. And in an ascomycete, there is a kind of sac-like structure, often elongated. Actually, in the first slide in my talk this afternoon will show you this. An ascomycete is like a sac or a bag, and it always has eight spores. There are some variations to that. There are a couple. There are a few that have four spores, but usually eight spores. Again, that's a microscopic feature that you really need to have a microscope to look at. So most of what we're seeing here today on these tables are basidiomycetes. There are a few ascomycetes. Sue found Chlorosaboria aeruginescens, which is hot right here. This is a fun one. Chlorosaboria aeruginescens is an ascomycete. It's a cup fungus. You can see the little aquamarine colored cups on this log. Usually we see this in the woods without those cups and simply a green stain in the wood from the mycelium of the fungus. And it's really quite remarkable. Sometimes you can see that in the wood right on the trail in many woodland areas. And this is really special. When I show this to Britt, I brought a smile to his face and some other people here too, because these are actually the little carpores or structures of the mycelium that's embedded in this wood. So that's an ascomycete. I don't know if there are any others. I think there may be Poseidza or something.
Ascomycete on basidiomycete.
Yes, ascomycete on basidiomycete. That, here, since you brought that up, we were talking about this on the trip. This is what's called a lobster mushroom. There's a group of fungi known as the Hypocreales. The Hypocrealian fungi include a genus, Hypomyces. And there are several species of Hypomyces, an ascomycete that parasitizes Russula and Lactarius, which are basidiomycetes. And one of them, what's the name, Britt? Hypomyces
Lactophorum.
Is parasitizing this and actually rendering this, whatever it is, a Russula or a Lactarius, it's rendering it edible. So that this has become something that people like to find as a choice edible mushroom. And it actually combines both of those groups because it's an ascomycete parasitizing of Ascidiomycete. There are other groups, which we really won't discuss today, that we did find a zygomycete out on the trail. Zygomycetes include things like Aspergillus and Penicillium, which appear as molds on fruit, et cetera, et cetera. So those we usually don't seek out in our mushroom clubs and don't really study as carefully. But knowing the main difference between a Basidiomycete and an Ascomycete is absolutely critical. And today we are chock full of Basidiomycetes that are boletes, coral mushrooms, a profusion of gill mushrooms, polypores, and some others.
Why is that distinction critical?
It's the defining feature between two phyla of the fungi. And fungi are classified much more specifically within a class and then a family and then a genus and a species based upon that great division. So I don't know whether we found any myxomycetes, but those are also something that mycologists seek out. Myxomycete? Here we go.
Just keep asking.
Thanks. Right. You know, can everyone see this little dot on this little piece of wood? Maybe not. Maybe not. This is our friend Lycaogala epidendrum. It's a myxomycete, also known as a slime mold. Slime molds are very interesting to me because it's an organism that has actually been classified in four different kingdoms. I mean, you wonder, how did science not know what kingdom to put this thing in? Well, it starts out as a spore and then a flagellated cell, and then it becomes a single plasmodium that is multinucleate, has thousands of nuclei in it, and it actually moves. So it was thought that it was an animal. It should be classified as an animal because it was motile and actually goes through this process of plasmodial streaming over the surface of a substrate, like a piece of wood, and engulfs bacteria. And then at some chemical signal, it stops and it sends up fruiting structures that are spore-bearing, very much like the fungi. So even though myxomycetes have been classified as animals, plants, fungi, and protists, they're really thought to be now in the kingdom of protists. I think the latest name is Eumycetozoa, which Zoa meaning animal. It gives the connotation of its movement over the surface. And those, although they are not true fungi, they are something that we have gone out and collected. So myxomycetes are they're quite colorful very often. Sometimes they're very large and not the little dot that you see on this, but it's another thing that is common to know in mycology. With that, I will stop and turn this over to Britt Bunyard, who may discuss specific species of mushrooms that we have here. I see a wonderful Amanita beaming up at the end of the table, and maybe we'll start with that, or maybe not. But remember, once again, Britt is going to say a few words about our collections. So will Paul Sadowski, and then we'll take a break, and then the program proper will start at about 1 o'clock.
Do what you gotta do.
Britt Bunyard.
So there's definitely some newbies here, or is everyone pretty well acquainted with questions?
No.
Some newbies? Okay.
Yeah.
So for sure, a great haul of stuff today here, and definitely all is not what it would seem to be on the table. We have a lot of mushrooms that for sure we know, and a lot of imposters. And so that might be kind of exciting to see today, because we have such a mix of stuff. So we have poisonous and edible Amanitas all around. There's Amanitas here, out there. We have, of course, Amanita muscarias that David prompted me to point out. There's some edible Amanitas at the other end. This is what's left of a destroying angel. This is probably the most dangerous mushroom that came in. This is, of course, for sure deadly. We saw lots and lots of corals. You saw a lot of stuff that you thought were corals, but are actually like false corals. Like that white one sitting just on the upholstery there is actually sitting around with corals. It's not a coral. It's a tremelodendron that looks like a coral. I saw true Matsutake today that I don't think was picked here, but brought in. And then we have imposters. We have not Satakis today, which actually are prettier. So we have things like. These were everywhere today. They're so beautiful. And everyone wants to eat them because they have to be Matsutake, but they're not. It's a very close relative, Tricholoma calligatum, way prettier than Matsutake's. Not the same thing. And another Natsutake that's even prettier than that one is the Tricholoma aurantium. And there are a few of these around which are just really pretty bronze and copper and greenish. Very close relative of Matsutake. I want it to be a Matsutake, but it's not. Yeah. So a lot of imposters. Everyone probably, even if you don't know that much about mushrooms, knows about chanterelles. We have fall chanterelle here. A really popular fall edible is a Tricholoma called Man on Horseback, which is spectacular. It looks just like this, but has bright lemon yellow gills. This is Tricholoma saponaceum, sort of like a false Man on Horseback. Don't eat this. It was, I think, whisked away into a locked box. And never be seen again until dinner time. These are also Tricholoma calligatum. So, doesn't that look like a Matsutake? No. If it was a Matsutake, you would smell lovely across the room.
But what do they smell like?
What do they smell like? So the different books talk about Matsutake smelling like cinnamon red pods, dirty gym socks. If you were kind of maple-y, I think they smell like an organic chemical called xylene. If you've ever worked in a biochemistry lab.
My daughter has the best description. Combination of cinnamon and lighthouse.
Yeah. It's sort of an unnatural smell, if you can't mistake it. They're really wonderful. About half of all non-Japanese love them, and about half of all non-Japanese hate them. About 99% of all Japanese would like murder you for one, because they're so fantastic. But, oh, look at some of these tricholomes. They're so beautiful, these giant fibrous veils. But I know they don't taste very good. Oh, so we started off the day finding stuff that looked just like bluets, and here's a bluet stuffed onto a table of what I guess you could call a false bluet, which is a quaternarius. And a lot of quaternaries are quite poisonous, some even deadly. Bluet's really, really a wonderful edible, but wow, look how similar.
So how do you tell them apart?
And wait a minute, oh, this is an imposter for this one, and this is a Lecaria. So how do you tell them apart? Well, spore color for one. So the quaternaries have rust-brown spores, and we talked about rust-brown spores on the wood in the trail. Lecarias have white spores, and the gills are more distant, and the stem is fibrous, and there's some other things about them. The true bluets have kind of a very pale pink, whitish, very light pink spore print, and they're a leaf rotter, so they usually have a lot of leaves and debris and junk stuck to the bottom. And then the smells and stuff would help you distinguish. We have lots of other purple mushrooms. We have several blue mushrooms. We have a lot of lactarius. We have blue lactarius, which will exude blue milk, and you can eat them. I mean, who would? Except for George Carlin, who wouldn't want to eat blue food, right? The lobster mushroom was pointed out. Oh, more imposters. So how about these, Jerry, when we came up on these big rushulas? Everyone agreed, yeah, those are for sure rushulas. And then we picked them, and they're like, oh, they're not rushulas. There's a species, Hygrophorus rushula. It's one of the wax caps that looks like a rushula. It's a really good edible. Hygrophorus rushula. And lots of them. And I see them intermingled with rushulas on the table because they fooled the experts. We have turkey tail and false turkey tail in the same plate here. Turn them over, they don't look the same underneath. One's perfectly smooth and one has kind of like teethy pores. Again, more amanitis. I bet we had probably 8 or 9 different species of amanitis. So really cool. Here's one of the edible amanitis. This is one that most people would probably call the tawny grisette. It's in section vaginate, so it doesn't have a ring, unlike all the other amanitis. Big boot on the bottom, which is kind of cool. It's an edible one, but this is actually not a tawny grisette. This is a fairly common one in this area called Mary Manning's amanita. And I think, was it Mary Manning's?
No, she was from Maryland.
Oh, from Maryland.
But she donated her collection of artwork to the New York State Museum of Charles Peck.
She did a lot of collaboration with Peck.
So there's a connection. So yeah, Amanita Beningiana is this one. So a little bit of a local connection. We have blushers and, this was pretty cool. So I saw things that you would maybe call pinboles, sort of like a porcino type mushroom. And we don't truly have, as far as anyone knows, the true Boletus sedulus in North America. We have stuff that looks and smells and is wonderful just like it. But based on DNA sequence analysis, that's European and didn't make it over here. Unless you look around certain trees, and that's Norway spruce, apparently the true Boletus edulis came to the New World, and you can find them under Norway spruce. And also, so did the true Panther amanita. So we have stuff that people call amanita pantherina, which is a fairly dangerously poisonous and gorgeous amanita. And this one I picked, there was a bunch of them on the campus under Norway spruce. So as best as I can tell, and I study amanitas, this is actually the true panther from Europe, growing with Norway spruce just like you'd expect. So as David pointed out, look at all the different features, and just within the amanitas you can see, you know, some of them have this saccate bulb with this boot at the bottom, and some don't quite have the boot. They have sort of this collar, and then stuff like the amanita muscaria, they don't even have a collar, it's just sort of rings on the bottom of the stem. But if you're new to mushrooming, and you see mushrooms, and you just pull them out of the ground and cut them because you think that's, you know, keeping them clean or whatever, very often you've lost the most important informative feature. So you would think maybe the top of the cap and the color is the most important thing. But it's not. A lot of species of amanitas look like this. A lot of species of tricholomas look like that. But notice how people pull the entire mushroom out so you can see the stem. And without the bottom of the stem on these guys, I mean, you wouldn't know what you had. This is another close relative of, this is the white panther. This is Amanita volatipi, or multisquamosa, and it's got another destroying angel. So the cup is not on this one. This should have a cup. So without the cup, this looks like an edible agaricus or leucoagaricus or other things that I'm going to take a bite. But had it been collected right, you see that saccate vulva and all these other characters. Oh, now it's a different species. Now it's for sure the destroying angel, which is a deadly poisonous. And here's some more destroying angels. Oh, wow. Here's a little baby one. So you see the whole cup. When amanitas first start up, they start up, it's what people call an egg. So it has a big covering over the whole mushroom, and it just starts popping out. You can see a lot of that, the bottom part of that cup. This is really spectacular. So these are, you're going to learn mushrooms to eat or whatever. This is where to start. No amanitas first, so you don't kill yourself or, you know, kill your dinner party, because that's embarrassing. But here's the sort of false coral mushrooms, right? All these corals and here's false corals mixed right in. So if I could throw one of these coral mushrooms at someone and it would shatter into pieces because they're fairly brittle. But if I threw one of these false corals at you, it really has nothing in common with the tissues of these guys. It would bounce off you. You have a tough time tearing them apart. They're pretty tough. Oh, and a baby hen of the woods, Grifola frondosa. This is one of the star performers of the fall this year because it's super choice edible. This is a little baby. And if you're new to mushrooming, David already pointed out the difference between like agarix with gills underneath and boletes and polypores, which have pores underneath. Which one is this, experts in that area? Okay, so you would know that how. What's the spore color, for example? Do you know the spore color? The reason I point this out is in the Midwest where I live, right now, the king boletes, in quotes, that are everywhere, people are ratcheting because they're so bitter and awful. God, what a dummy bunny it is. Those king boletes are the worst question ever. What about king boletes? Yeah, they are. They look like a king bolete. Did you see the spore color? Was it white underneath? Yeah. Except for the big ones. Then the pores turn pink. Well, only the essentials does have pink spores. That's a Tylopolis, and it's extremely bitter. So this one, in the Midwest, we had separates everywhere about a month ago. They were all over the place. So, yeah, so they're, I guess, still to know. So, a very beautiful bully to know.
Wait, what species
did you say about? Xerocomus. X-E-R-O-C-O-M-O.
Xerocomus, Xerocomus separans, with an S. And, ooh, I found a little baby one of this too. It wasn't so pretty as this one. So, this was sort of an imposter, I guess, to the person who named it. So, this is Oxyphorus populinus, which never is anywhere near any sort of populous species ever. I don't know how to name it. It's always maple. This is the mossy maple polypore. But very often you'll pass right by it because it's all moss covered. If you can see underneath, it's all pretty pores and white. It's a neat sort of parasitic polypore on trees. That's as pretty as it gets. I always really like this. It's like a little terrarium. Mm. And How about Glow in the Dark mushrooms? There's jack-o'-lanterns coming out here. That's another pretty one that people sometimes mistake for chanterelle, so I guess you could call that a full chanterelle and quite toxic.
And bioluminescent.
And bioluminescent will glow in the dark very brightly. It's glowing right now, you just can't see it because it's light out. So what do you call these?
Turkey
tails, and yep, these are all turkey tails. So they're all white kind of poured underneath. These are totally turkey tails. And these are super common, little shelf polypore that rots wood all around the world, and sort of a popular medicinal mushroom too. People like make a lot of tea and things from them. Oh, with these. Oh, and right next to them, that was a nice touch by somebody. False turkey tails. Right next to the turkey tails. So these look like turkey tails, but when you flip them over, you can see there's something different about them. So these are actually Asterium, and they're not really even that closely related. And sometimes with Asterium, you can see some of the witch's butter hanging out nearby because it's a parasite on this. Was there anything else exciting that anyone saw before I turned over to Paul? Paul's pretty much a little expert. This is a good one to point out. So I was actually trying to hit on also some of the ones that I have pictures of in my slideshow. So that I have a slide of this one. I would normally never have ever picked this up because this is like the weed of all woods. This is the Calibia or Gymnopus dryophilus, the loving Calibia, which it's also a misnomer. It rots any kind of leaves. It's all over the forest. And it's just normally a weed that no one's too interested in. But I have a pretty picture of it being parasitized by another fungus in the slideshow, so I wanted to show one of these.
Can we talk about this brown toothed fungi
at
the front?
These?
Yeah.
Oh, here you go.
All right.
Sure, let's have Paul take it away, because he's the local expert. He can tell
you. So we have a number of toothed fungi. All right, now you have, what I wanted to do was, kind of go through this in a general way, because I know that you have questions. I've been asked a number of questions. And if you understand the biology of fungi, it will answer a lot of those questions for you. So the whole show begins with a spore. A spore is a unicellular item. It contains oils, it contains sugar. It's essentially the seed of the fungus. And so the first thing that happens is it sends out a shoot, not unlike a vascular plant would do. And this shoot is known as a hypha. And all of these mushrooms that are on the table are composed of that very simple shoot, the simplest of all cells. And these cells clone themselves, okay? So this thing starts off with one set of chromosomal matter. It makes its way through a substrate, be it soil or wood or rock. And at the end of each of these hyphae, which branch and proliferate, you will have ends of these hyphae, which will exude an enzyme that will go into the adjacent area, break it down, and then it'll be reabsorbed into the fungi. So the fungi live in their food. This is how they sustain themselves. Okay, so one question people ask is, I went out and I found a whole bunch of chicken on this log last year. And I went back there this year around the same time of year, and there's no chicken. How come? And I say, well, the reason is that the mycelium of the fungi had made its way through the substrate, the wood. It interpenetrated every cell and digested lignin. And by the time it finished, there was no more lignin. And so there's no more mushroom. So it had extinguished its food supply. And then it's time to move on to another substrate. Okay? So the mycelium is by far the greatest part of the biomass of the organism. You have to think, when you see a mushroom sitting out there on the ground, you're seeing a very, very small part of the actual biomass. And it's not quite so evident here, but there's a green stain that is throughout this wood. And I'd like to show this to people because it illustrates beautifully how completely the fungus interpenetrates all of the cells. And in the case of Chloris aureo aerogenesis, the exudations are green colored, and so they leave the stain on the wood. So keep that in mind when you're thinking about picking a mushroom, because the question came to me today, am I hurting the organism? And I'm saying, no, because the organism is much larger than the fruiting body. And there is, so it's really quite proliferant and healthy underneath. And this fruiting body is basically the end stage for this mycelium. So the fruiting bodies of these fungi are quite specialized. They're pretty simple when they leave the spore, but then they will be in the substrate and they will find a mating pair. There'll be two fungi of the same species, and they'll meet up and they actually merge their cells. Okay, there was this, when we were kid boys, you know, we would have this joke, we would shake hands with somebody and say, I'm a Martian, we just had sex. Well, basically, that's what fungi do. And in that interchange, they will then combine their two chromosomal packages, and they will have two nuclei in each cell. And then at that point, and only at that point, will there be a fruiting body ultimately, or can be a fruiting body ultimately. A monochromosomal mycelium will not produce a fruiting body, only a diploid one. So that there are mushrooms at all boggles my mind. The chances of it are very, very slim, but they're able to proliferate because they produce massive numbers of spores, billions of spores in each fruiting body. So just a little bit of consideration there. The mycelium will proliferate in this diploid state, and they'll produce nodal points, okay, underground. And some of the nodal points will be basically generative points for the following year, in the case of morels, for example. But in many cases, these nodal points become fruiting bodies. And so the hyphae in the fruiting bodies become very highly specialized. So the stem, for example, when examined microscopically, will be parallel cells running up and down, for the most part. The egg that Rick was explaining, the universal veil, will be something like an interwoven structure, and so it's rather durable. And so forth with the gills and the cortex, that is the meat of the mushroom, and the cap. So people walk up to me sometime and say, what's this mushroom? And I say, what's this mushroom? Is it this one? And I say, yes. And they say, it doesn't look the same. And the reason it doesn't look the same is because this is a young mushroom and this is an old mushroom. And sometimes the size of the mushroom is not an indication of age. What is an indication of age is how convex the cap is, or how upturned the cap is. So that's the thing that we look for. And this is a result of the specialization of the various hyphae that make up the mushroom. So in this case, the mushroom is rather viscid, it's been wet on the cap. In this case, it's dried out. And so like that scrub sponge that you might have sitting on your kitchen sink, the scrubby part dries out more quickly or more thoroughly than the spongy part does. And so it kind of curls up because they're different cellular material. And that is, in turn, optimizes the chances of spores being distributed because that tightens it up and it exposes the yellow pores to air and thus helps to distribute spores. So we have gilled mushrooms. Most of the mushrooms found today are gilled mushrooms. We have bolies, which have tubes underneath. We have polypores, which also have tubes underneath. And the difference between the polypore, like this, and the boly, like this, and I don't know, may I destroy this a little bit?
Yes.
Is that so? You can very easily see the pores here, but this is the tubes. And the pores are basically the ends of the tubes that you're looking at. And in a boli, this pore surface is very separable from the cap. Whereas in a polypore, you can't do that. Okay, so that's a big difference between the boli and the polypore. In addition, the polypore has a number of different types of hyphae that they are composed of, and consequently, they're durable. Because in the case of all of these fleshy mushrooms, the things that last for a week and then fall down and melt away, they have just one kind of hyphae that is composing them. Whereas in the case of the polypores, there can be up to three different kinds. So these structural differences account for the persistence of polypores. And in the case of polypores, make them particularly efficient distributors of spores because they can have, they'll have a fruiting time when they come out of the wood and they'll distribute spores. But then they may dry up and sit there in a latent state for some time. And then in wet weather, such as we had this year, you'll see them popping out. One of the things about the season was just to see how happy the polypores were. They were so colorful. Normally they're like these little dried up things, but God, they were just so happy to be here. And you knew they were putting out spores. And then there'd be a dry spell, and then boom, out they come again. So I just want you to appreciate how simple at once these mushrooms are, but how complicated. Now, to answer the question about this one, so you have teeth underneath. So we have gills and pores and teeth. We have a bunch of hedgehog mushrooms. Okay, so these two, this is a very good escalator. However, I'll mention if you find them, particularly older ones, you better check and take a little taste because they can become rather bitter as they get older. Okay, but this one is a rather rubbery tooth. It's really a polypore for intents and purposes. And this one is called Hidnellum scrobiculatum. So to be scrobiculate is to grow in a sort of haphazard, somewhat lobe-like lobes and haphazard. And this mushroom grows in that way. And we find lots of hidden elements, so they're kind of tough. They're not, they look real good, but you'll have a hard time eating them. So, which one is the best for eating? Okay, so by far, this is the best one. I will mention to you to be careful if you are if you are on any kind of immune suppressant. This one is an immune booster, so take it easy. But it's certainly enjoyable. Enjoy it while you can.
We ate those for dinner, huh?
Yes. They're delicious. And by the way, just when you find them, often you're going to find a lot of them. So you'll have enough to share with your friends. Pure generous.
Thank you so much, all three of you.